Chapter 27. Carrie sat in her car at the far back of the parking lot, tapping her fingernail against the window glass. She had the police radio turned down to a whisper, just in case anyone walked close. It was dark, and that was good. The vehicle they were looking for wasn't in the parking lot, and that was good, too. She wanted to see the man before she had to go inside. The speaker mounted under her dashboard hummed to life, and Steve Auburn said, "Target vehicle turning in now. You'll have the eye." Carrie raised the binoculars sitting in her lap and watched the large silver Cadillac with tinted windows and chrome rims pull in. It headed toward the back of the lot, not far from her, and Carrie sunk down in her seat. When she pumped her head back up, the Cadillac was parked on the line between two spots, taking them both up. Carrie muttered, "What a douche." Fred Eubanks exited the vehicle and headed for the bar's rear door. Carrie clicked the microphone's button. "I've got eyes on him." Steve Auburn's voice crackled through the speaker. "Copy that." The disdain in Auburn's voice was mild but present. It had been present ever since Carrie had pointed to Eubanks in the yearbook at the station and said, "That's our guy." "Fred Eubanks," Auburn had said. "The insurance agent. Sponsor of the Little League team that won the regional championship 2 years ago. Jesus Christ, Carrie, he paid for the party when I got sworn in as chief. He's on the school board, the Rotary Club, everything. That's who you want to accuse of raping and murdering Hope Pugh? Why, because he was mean to a couple geeks when he was a kid?" "So he grew up and became respectable," Carrie had said, looking at Eubanks' yearbook photo. "Doesn't mean he didn't do it." Carrie looked at the clock on the dash. She wanted to give him time to get a drink or two down to loosen him up. She pulled down the visor and slid the mirror panel back, pressing her lips together to coat them bright red with the most expensive lipstick she could find at the local drugstore. She tore the mascara packaging open and did her eyelashes next, drawing them out thick and long. When she finished, she turned her head to look at herself in the mirror from either side. It wasn't an expert job by any means, but it would do. She picked up the radio again. "You sure I'm good to go?"
"It's all taken care of," Auburn replied. "Just walk on in like you own the place."
The problem was her gun. She had no way to conceal it without keeping on her coat, and no way to keep on her coat and still accomplish the mission. She pulled it out of her holster and thought about trying to squeeze it in her purse or pocket, but that was a no-go. Glocks are good combat weapons because they can take a lot of abuse and still fire, but the damn things have no safety. The gun was more likely to go off accidentally than it was to be of use when she really needed it. "Here I go, doing something stupid," she said aloud as she undid her belt and slid the holster off. She stuck the gun back inside the holster and dropped it into the car's glove box, along with her purse. "Rookie female detective gets taken hostage by suspected child murderer," she said, picturing it printed on a newspaper page hanging outside of Harv Bender's office. "That's gonna look great." She picked up the microphone and clicked it, saying, "Going inside now. I'll be off radio."
"Roger that," Auburn said.
Carrie hung up the microphone and reached in for a pack of gum in the coffee holder. She stuck a piece in her mouth and slid the rest in her pocket and got out. It was time to go inside. She opened the door to the bar and was hit by the stench of disinfectant and dirty water from a mop and bucket parked near the entrance. Dull rock music played on the jukebox in the corner. Mid-tempo garbage, but the people playing pool in the corner bobbed their heads to it anyway. She caught glances right away as the door closed behind her, men and women alike sizing her up. Carrie worked her way past the row of booths and around the pool table, getting a good look at where Fred Eubanks was sitting. Eubanks leaned over his drink at the bar, stirring it with a small plastic saber. He looked older than his driver's license photo, with thinning black hair and sagging jowls. He was bigger than she'd expected. Large hands and thick, hairy wrists. Carrie went behind the bar. She waved to the bartender and said, "Hey, I'm Carrie. Are you Paul?" The bartender picked up a towel and wiped his hands.
"You the new girl?"
"That's right. I'm supposed to hang out with you for an hour, see how things are done."
"What drinks do you know how to make?"
"Does rum and coke count?" she asked. Vodka and cran? Pretty much anything you just have to pour together?
Just watch and learn, Paul said. He tapped the bar to get Eubanks' attention.
You want another drink, Fred?
I'm good, thanks. Need to get home a little early tonight, Eubanks said, not looking up. His drink was almost done.
Give me a shout when you're ready to go,
Paul said, heading down to the other end of the bar to check on the rest of the customers. How about a beer for the road? Gary asked. Liquor before beer, never fear, isn't that what they say?
Eubanks declined. I'll cash out.
Sure thing, Gary said. Let me go get your check. She hurried across the bar to where Paul was filling two glasses of beer and pressed close to him. Go in the back.
What do you mean? I have customers, he whispered.
Steve said this wouldn't interfere with anything.
Get your ass in the back and don't come out until I tell you to, she said, pulling the half-filled glasses out of his hands.
Paul tried to protest, but Carrie grabbed him by the arm and shoved him through the double doors into the kitchen. She picked up the two half-filled glasses of beer and set them in front of the customers.
Something's wrong with the taps, she said. These are on the house.
She returned to Eubanks and said, It's going to be a few minutes. There's a problem in the back.
It's always something in this place, Eubanks said.
He pulled a $20 bill off a roll as thick as a tennis ball and tossed it on the bar.
Keep the change.
Wait,
Carrie said, slapping her hand down on top of the bill.
You can't.
Why not? Eubanks scowled.
I'm not allowed to accept money yet, she improvised. They told me that when I started.
Listen, just wait a few minutes for Paul to come back, okay?
Hang out with me. I don't know anybody here.
There's hardly anybody worth knowing in here, Eubanks said.
He slid back into the bar stool and checked the time on his watch.
I guess people in this town would rather play pool than drink, Carrie said.
There were two people at the other end of the bar, and a small group gathered around the pool tables. The only other person was sitting by himself in a booth, resting his head on the table, covering his face with the hood of his sweatshirt. She picked up Eubanks' empty drink and realized she had no idea what to do with it. She dumped the ice cubes in the nearest trash can and dropped the glass in the sink, splattering herself with soapy water.
Have you ever worked in a bar before?
Eubanks asked, watching her.
It's that obvious, Carrie said, wiping her hands on her pant legs.
You're a pretty young girl. Even if you don't have any idea what you're doing, you'll still make more money in a single night than Paul does in a week. Especially if you wear something low-cut.
Well, I'd like to just make enough money to pay my student loans, she said.
Tell me about it, Eubanks said. My little girl's about to graduate next year. With the way my wife spends, we won't be able to afford community college.
Hey, Carrie said. As a special thank you for being so patient, let me make you something.
I don't like rum and coke, Eubanks said.
It's an old family recipe, Carrie said, grabbing two bottles off the shelf. It's special, trust me. What were you drinking before?
Gin and tonic.
Ugh,
she said over her shoulder as she poured various liquors into a tall glass.
I drank gin once and thought I was going to be sick for a week. It tasted like the Great Depression.
She grabbed a straw and stirred.
What in the world is that?
Eubanks said, eyeing the yellowish-brown concoction in her hands.
That's a secret, Carrie said, sitting it in front of him. Go ahead and try it. It'll put hair on your chest.
Eubanks pointed at his neck where thick tufts of hair sprouted and said,
I think I'll be okay on that end.
Well, if you don't drink it, I'm going to have to tell everybody you were a sissy.
Eubanks snorted with laughter.
Good luck with that.
He picked up the drink and raised it to his lips, and Carrie cried out, Hang on! She dug in her pocket, fishing for the pack of gum.
I almost forgot the most important part.
She held a stick of gum out and said,
You have to chew this first.
Why?
The residual flavor. It's a big part of it. Come on, take it. Just chew it a few times and spit it out, then drink.
Eubanks leaned sideways to look past the double doors, checking for Paul. The bartender was nowhere to be found.
Oh, what the hell?
He said, taking the gum between his teeth.
Just chew a few times? He asked.
Just like that,
Carrie said, reaching for a napkin.
Make sure you get it on both sides of your mouth. Spread that flavor all over the place. Eubanks chewed, and when Carrie said that was enough, he bent forward and spit the gum into the napkin on the table. He picked up the glass, swallowed a mouthful of the mixture, and gagged, clutching his throat.
"Christ, that's disgusting," he rasped, spitting the rest out of his mouth across the bar.
Carrie snatched the napkin, holding his gum off the bar, and ran to the other end of the bar. The man slumped over, bounced up from his booth, throwing back his hood to reveal his shining bald head. Steve Auburn thrust a paper envelope toward Carrie, and she dropped the napkin and chewed up gum inside it. From his seat, Fred Eubanks watched this unfold in slack-jawed astonishment. Steve Auburn closed the envelope and stuffed it in his back pocket, eyes fixed on Eubanks, daring him to make a sudden move.
"Steve?" Eubanks said, blinking in confusion. "What the hell's going on?"
Carrie shoved the double doors open and stuck her head into the kitchen.
"All done, Paul, you can come out now."
She walked past where Eubanks sat and said,
"Nice meeting you, Fred. By the way, I'm Detective Santero, and you'll be seeing me in a few weeks with an arrest warrant for the rape and murder of Hope Pugh."
"Who?"
Eubanks said, laughing.
"Rape and murder? What the hell are you talking about?"
He looked at Auburn.
"This is some sort of joke, right?"
"Is it, Fred?"
Auburn asked.
"We found semen from the crime scene, and you just gave us a DNA sample. Are they going to match?"
People moved back as Eubanks got down from his stool. He raised his voice so everyone could hear him.
"Are you seriously accusing me of that crime? Do you realize I will sue you and everyone you know for even suggesting such a thing?"
"Come on," Auburn said, leading Carrie toward the exit.
"Anyway, you can't use that gum as evidence," Eubanks called out. "You didn't get it from me legally. That's called entrapment."
He pointed at the other patrons.
"You all saw that. You're all witnesses. They just tried to entrap me."
"You spit it out, genius," Carrie said from the door. "That's called abandonment. I can use that all day."
The door closed behind them and reopened seconds later, with Fred Eubanks bursting through it.
"Steve, hang on,"
Eubanks said, racing after them across the parking lot.
"Steve, come on, quit fooling around. You know me. Everyone knows I'm not the kind to hurt anybody."
His voice broke as he said,
"You can't do this to me. I have a family. I have a daughter. Steve, please."
"My God, Fred," Auburn whispered. "It was you. How the hell could you do something like that?"
"I was a kid,"
Eubanks shouted. He sank to his knees on the asphalt and buried his face in his hands.
"Just a dumb, stupid kid. It was an accident. I didn't know any better. Please, I'm begging you, don't do this to me."
"Your daughter, were you good to her when she was little, Fred?" Carrie asked. "You give her a childhood filled with birthday parties and hugs and stuffed animals?"
"Of course I did," Eubanks said. "All of that."
"So she grew up happy, right?"
"Because she had a good dad. I am a great dad," Eubanks said. "Ask anyone."
"Here's what I wonder sometimes, Fred. When a little kid gets murdered, what are they thinking about? Are they thinking about all of the parties and hugs and stuffed animals? Or is it just blind terror? Do those few moments of torment erase all of the good that was in their lives? Because we tell ourselves it doesn't. Whenever some kid gets killed, we tell ourselves they had great lives right up until then, that we'll try to focus on the good stuff. But in reality, they're not thinking about any of the good things when it happens. They die in fear and torment, and that's it. You murdered Hope Pugh, Fred. We both know it. You raped her, then you killed her, then you hid her body out in the mountains. And you spent all these years pretending it didn't happen, hoping this day would never come, but guess what? It did. Now you're fucked."
Eubanks sobbed into his hands. His gold bracelet and watch jingled as his body jerked back and forth.
"Oh my God," he moaned between his fingers. "God, please help me, Lord Jesus. Please help me, I beg you."
Carrie leaned back on the hood of her car, folded her arms and looked down at him.
"You want help?" Carrie asked. Yes, anything, Eubanks said. Please.
Tell you what, Carrie said. If you mean it, and you really want help, I will make you a one-time offer. Do not piss me off, and do not try to negotiate with me, or it's off the table. Ready?
You give us a written statement tonight saying it was an accident, saying you didn't mean to kill her. I'll even let you write a letter of apology to her family and say you were just a dumb, scared kid who made a mistake. I'll make sure the district attorney and the judge both see it. But you had better tell us every single thing that happened that night.
Eubanks wiped his face on his sleeves, leaving them dark and stained.
You'd do that?
As long as you cooperate, she said. Do you agree to go back to the police station, not in custody, and give us a statement of your own free will?
I'll do whatever I can. I have to think about my family, he said, getting up from the ground.
Get in your car and wait for us back at the station, then. You okay to drive? You want a coffee?
Eubanks ran his hand through his sweaty hair and took a deep breath.
No, he said. I just want to get this over with.
He fished in his pocket for his keys and headed for his car. He stumbled as he walked, dazed like a heavyweight who has just been knocked into oblivion but doesn't have the sense to fall. Steve Auburn leaned on the hood of Carrie's car, watching as Eubanks drove out of the parking lot toward the police station.
Let me get this straight, he said. You're going to do him the favor of letting him make a written confession?
I didn't lie, Carrie said. The first people I'm going to show it to are the DA and the judge. Right after I convince them to try him as an adult and send him to prison for the rest of his life.
We have enough to arrest him tonight, Auburn said. Soon as that confession is signed.
Let's wait, Carrie said. Do the forensics on his DNA sample. Take our time writing the criminal complaint. With a case like this, it's better to go slow and have all our ducks in a row.
I can't believe it, Auburn whispered. After all this time.
He looked up at the night sky, staring deep into the cosmos.
You seeing this, Pop? We did it.
He dug in his pocket for his cell phone and said,
I've got to make a phone call.
Carrie watched him press his phone to his ear as he walked away, going back across the parking lot to where his car was parked around front.
Mom, Auburn said, his voice quivering with excitement. You awake? I never thought I'd be able to tell you this, but I want you to know something. I closed Dad's last case.
Carrie could hear him choking up, telling his mom.
The Pew Girl. The last thing he was working on before he passed. I just caught the man who killed her.
Carrie got into her car and sat, not turning it on. Her breath was cool against the windshield, fogging it as she breathed. A couple came out of the bar, hugging one another and laughing as they headed for their car. Carrie shivered and buttoned her shirt. She grabbed her coat from behind her seat and put it on. She started the car, turned on the heat, and let it warm her bare legs. She drove past the couple as they were leaning against their car, kissing, their eyes closed, hands clasped, lost in one another. Carrie turned on the radio and sang to herself as she waited to turn out of the lot to go back to the police station. She didn't know the words to the song, but the sound of her voice filled the empty space in her car. Chapter 28. On the night before Hope Pugh's funeral, Fred Eubanks lowered his glasses and peered at the computer screen in his bedroom. He clicked on his My Sellers account, his legs bouncing up and down as he waited for the page to load.
Come on, he whispered,
then read the screen and shouted,
Two sales! That's what I'm talking about!
Both of his gold Rolex watches had sold. It was no surprise. They were his most valuable items, worth thousands of dollars apiece. He'd almost strangled the we-buy-gold assholes for the price they offered him for his bracelets and rings. Fucking junkie enablers is all they were. He clicked on the sales page and froze. They had to be the wrong numbers, he told himself,
He took off his glasses and pressed his face close to the screen, wanting to read it with his own eyes. $350 for the first Rolex, and $500 for the second? No way, he said. Fuck that. There was no button to cancel the sale. He clicked around until he found the customer service page. There was no phone number or email address, just FAQs that said nothing, followed by questions reading, "Was this information helpful?" He bellowed and threw his keyboard across the room, smashing it against his wife Karen's assortment of perfume bottles, sending them scattering. He picked one up. It was a quarter empty and 4 years old. A $180 bottle of Chloe bullshit he couldn't sell. Next to it was a $585 bottle of Tom Ford bullshit he couldn't sell. You'd think she'd fucking use one up before buying four new ones, he thought, hurling both bottles at the dresser mirror. Shards of glass flew. Her spending had them so overleveraged he couldn't even take a loan out to pay his attorney's retainer. They'd been all smiles when he met with them the day after he'd been formally charged, telling him they'd get right on it, and he assured them the check would clear. It didn't. He'd managed to get a little more work out of them in the ensuing 2 weeks, but now they weren't returning his phone calls. Eubanks sat on the bed, holding the sides of his head. The phone rang on the nightstand. Wiping sweat out of his eyes, he picked up the receiver and said, "Hello." "It's your brother. How are you?" Richie asked.
"I'm fine. Everything's great," Eubanks said.
"That's good to hear, Fred. I wanted you to know we prayed for you at my congregation tonight. We prayed that the Lord will deliver you from the hands of your accusers. We prayed that the light of God's mercy will shine on our entire community."
"Sounds good," Eubanks said. "Listen, I have to get going. We'd like you to come to the house tomorrow during the funeral. We'll pray for that poor child and her family, and you will feel the blessing of Jesus himself when you surrender yourself to him." "I have to meet with someone about my case tomorrow," Eubanks said. "But I appreciate it." "Another time then, brother. Remember, the Lord is here for you when you are ready for him." "Thanks," Eubanks said, and hung up the phone. He went back to his computer and clicked new message. He typed in the names of his attorneys and wrote, "Guys, just letting you know the sales went great. I will have your money as soon as it comes through. Not sure how these things work. I never sold anything online before, ha ha. Glad to still have you on my side. Let me know how things are proceeding." Eubanks picked up the phone again and dialed his mother-in-law's house. It rang 5 times and he hung up. He called it back, letting it ring longer, and it went to voicemail. He called again. His wife picked up and said, "I told you I'd call you. My mother doesn't want you calling here."
"Karen, I need to talk to Jessie. It's important."
"She's busy right now," she said.
"Yeah? Does she like having a cell phone? Because I pay for that. Does she like driving a car? Because I pay for that too. Tell her to pick up the goddamn phone."
Eubanks rocked back and forth, waiting for his daughter to pick up. When she did, she didn't say anything.
"Hey, sweetie," he said. "How's it going over there? Your grandma driving you nuts yet?"
"It's fine," Jessie mumbled.
"Listen, I just need to set a few things straight, okay? I know you heard a lot about this in the news, but I want you to hear the truth from me. From your dad. Can you listen to me for a minute, please?"
There was no response.
"I didn't kill that little girl," Eubanks said. "I never touched her. I was never anywhere near her. That's the truth. I swear it on my life. I'll swear it on a stack of Bibles. Those cops, they set me up. First they got me drunk, and then they conned me into signing some bullshit statement. I didn't even read it before I signed it. My mistake, okay? I trusted the cops to be good people, and now I gotta pay the price for it. It happens to people every day in this screwed-up country, but this time, it happened to me."
"The news said the police have evidence it was you," Jessie said.
Of course that's what the fake news says. All they want is to make money. Nothing else happens around here, and I'm a big name, so as long as they keep doing stories about me, people will keep watching.
He bit his lower lip, hoping she'd say something.
Listen, you believe me, don't you?
I don't know, Dad, she whispered. Grandmom said,
forget what she said. That crazy old bat's had it in for me for years. All I care about is me and you. What you think and whether or not you believe me. Do you?
I guess so, Jesse said, keeping her voice down.
Eubanks clenched his mouth together to keep her from hearing him sob.
That's all I needed to hear. I love you, baby. I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Okay, she said, and hung up.
He hung up the phone and lowered his face into his hands. The lights from the office of Eubanks Insurance spilled out onto Auburn Street. An occasional car drove past, its headlights reflecting off the dark windows. Inside, Fred Eubanks was crouched on the floor, pulling everything out of his safe. Protected documents for his clients, social security numbers, bank account details. Everything had value if you knew how to find the right buyer. It might take him some time, but he'd figure it out. He heard the office door open and stuck his head up above his desk.
We're closed, he said.
The shabbily dressed, bearded man standing in the entrance didn't move. Eubanks was about to open the desk drawer where he kept his pistol when the man said,
Hello, Fred. Been a long time.
Eubanks dropped the papers and stood up, squinting to see better.
Do we know each other, friend?
He moved around the front of his desk and leaned back against it, better able to make out the details of the man's face.
Holy shit, he said.
Piss face?
Jacob Rain sat down on one of the chairs and folded one leg over the other. He pressed his fingers together under his chin, revealing the wide circular scar that wrapped around his left wrist.
Wow. You look like hell, Eubanks said. I guess time hasn't been too good to you. I heard you were a cop, then you got locked up. How was prison?
I don't recommend it, Rain said.
How are you?
I'm good, Eubanks said. I'm great, in fact. I guess you heard about this bullshit case the cops are trying to put on me. I just got off the phone with my legal team, and man, what we are going to do to them in court is going to be disgusting. They're going to be begging for mercy. I'm going to sue the shit out of every single person involved in this. They'll have to rename Auburn Street to Eubanks Street. You'll see.
Wouldn't surprise me at all if they did, Rain said. The way Rain's eyes stayed on him was infuriating. The calm way he sat there, staring, was enough to make Eubanks want to pull out the pistol and shoot him on the spot.
You just come to stare at me, or did you have something you wanted? I'm a little busy and don't really have the time to shoot the shit, even with an old friend like Pissface.
I just came to see whether or not you are the kind to make it through this, Rain said.
What the fuck is that supposed to mean? Of course I'm going to make it through this. I just told you my attorneys are... You know what? Just get out. I don't have time to talk to you.
You asked about prison. I'll tell you. It can be hard in there. For anyone, Rain said. The isolation, the loneliness, being cut off from the ones you love, not being there to protect them or provide for them. I was only there a little while, but the time I lost and the things I missed, I'll never get back.
Well, I'm not going to prison, so I don't have to worry about that.
It can be especially terrible if you've done things to children, Rain continued. The men in prison might be criminals, killers, drug addicts, gang members. But even they have children. They tend to take out their frustrations on child predators. The guards, of course, look the other way. The only thing they'll do is put you on suicide watch, keep you from ending the pain, making sure it goes on as long as you're there. Eubanks felt his legs trembling with a rage that ran all the way up into his throat,
I told you to get out! Stop talking about that shit! To be honest, Fred, Rain said, by the time you get that far, it won't mean anything. By then, you'll have already endured the worst human misery possible. You'll have been exposed. Not just in front of the public, but in front of your family. Your daughter. All your lies and bravado will be cut down by irrefutable forensic evidence. Lab reports that say your DNA matches the semen found at the crime scene and the fingerprint on the knife you left behind. Your little girl will spend the rest of her life knowing her father raped a 12-year-old right before he strangled her to death. Rain stood up. By the time you finally wind up in prison, you'll be so hollowed out inside you won't even care what the inmates are doing to you. Everything about your life, even this conversation, will seem like a distant dream. So keep telling yourself you have this under control, that there's a way out. But we both know the truth. You are caught in the jaws of the beast, and it's just getting started on you. He leaned closer, speaking into Eubanks's ear. Do you know why I never came after you myself when I was a detective? I was afraid. I knew I'd kill you before I got the chance to watch you suffer. Rain stepped back, grinning. Then again, he said, eyes shining with cruelty, I still might. Rain pushed the door open and stepped out onto the sidewalk, taking a deep breath of the fresh night air. Inside the office, Fred Eubanks slammed his fists on his desk and thrust himself into his chair, sending stacks of paper flying. Rain stood there long enough to listen to the cries of anguish erupt from inside the office. They were like sweet music. He smiled, and then he walked away. Chapter 29. Cameras and news vans were setting up around the cemetery hours before the burial. One of the cameramen saw Steve Auburn's police car approaching and turned to film it. A few of them tried flagging him down, wanting him to give a few comments, but he kept driving. He went past the church, and there were news crews there, too. At least they were leaving the pews alone. Auburn was paying a few of his officers overtime to take shifts sitting in front of their house, making sure nobody bothered them. The speaker on his dashboard crackled, followed by, "Chief, you on radio?" Auburn picked up his microphone. "Affirmative, Paul, you need something?" "Meet me at Eubanks Insurance, sir. Step it up, please." Auburn snapped the microphone back in its holder and groaned. What could possibly be happening now? Somebody had probably vandalized the place, he figured. The townsfolk were pretty pissed off, and someone probably threw a brick through the office windows. He aimed his Crown Vic toward the cemetery's exit and drove. By the time he pulled up behind Paul's police car, he realized nothing was wrong with the office. The windows were intact, nothing was smashed or broken. It hadn't even been egged. "Steve, come on," Paul urged, looking up and down the street. Passing cars were slowing down to look at what the cops were doing. Paul waved and smiled at them, calling out, "Hey, Bob," and "Morning, Mrs. Klein," as they passed. But he looked pale and sweaty despite the cold November chill. Whatever it was that happened, it had been too important for the idiot to remember to put on his hat, Auburn thought. "What the hell's going on?" Auburn said, shutting the car door. "I got a call from Fred's wife this morning," Paul said. "She said she went home to get some things, and the bedroom was all smashed up. When she couldn't get him on the phone, she called dispatch and asked us to check on him here." He cocked his head in the insurance office's window, pointing at what was inside. "So I did." Auburn pressed himself against the smoked glass and cupped his hands to the side of his face, trying to see in. Fred Eubanks was splayed across his desk, his pistol still gripped by his rigid fingers. His eyes were permanently wide and vacant. Chunks of his skull and brain matter were splattered across the wall next to him. Thick gelatinous blood pooled beneath his head and spilled over the desk's sides, forming dark puddles on the carpet below.
Son of a motherfucking whore, Auburn said.
I figured you want to know right away before any of them news people show up, Paul said.
Auburn reached to pull the door open, finding it was locked.
Get the crowbar out of my trunk and bring the camera. We need to take photographs and get that body out of sight before the press shows up.
Yes, sir,
Paul said, hurrying for the police car.
And Paul,
Auburn said, halting the man in his tracks,
put on your damn hat.
Inside Ruby's Diner, video footage of Pastor Richard Eubanks appeared on the TV set over the cashier's counter.
God will ensure that justice is done in this matter, as in all things. I have faith that my brother's name will be cleared, and the true murderer will be revealed.
Little Richie said, waving a Bible at the camera.
Turn off that horse shit, shouted one of the truckers seated next to Carrie. Frederick was never a violent person. He is a loving father and husband and founding member of this congregation, the pastor continued. The people looking to tear him down are doing so for political reasons, I believe.
Cut this off, another trucker yelled. They should fry that lying son of a bitch in the electric chair with his damn brother.
Carrie ate the last of her eggs and wiped the corner of her mouth with a napkin, then took a sip of her coffee, careful not to spill any on her new blouse. The people inside the diner that morning were all dressed better than usual. The truckers had their hair combed. The waitresses were wearing their church shoes and skirt under their aprons. A handwritten sign on the door read, "Closed from 10 to 3 today for funeral." The door opened behind her and she heard someone say,
"Morning, Chief."
"Morning," Steve Auburn replied.
Carrie glanced over her shoulder to see Auburn dressed in his uniform, his cowboy hat fixed atop his head.
"You got a minute?" he said, coming up alongside her.
Carrie tossed a $10 bill on the counter, then waved goodbye and followed Auburn out the door. The wind was soft and calm. It was an unusually warm day for that time of year. Auburn's face wrinkled behind his sunglasses.
"Fred Eubanks is dead," Auburn said.
"You're shitting me."
"He shot himself in his office last night. We just found him a little while ago."
Carrie rummaged in her purse for her keys. "I need to see the body. Where is it?"
"Coroner already took him," Auburn said.
"Were there any signs of forced entry?"
"No, the door was locked from inside," Auburn said.
"What, you think someone killed him and staged it?"
"There were notes spread out all over the desk for his wife, his daughter, his brother. I can't give you any of them yet because there's blood all over the damn things. With the funeral today and all the press, I guess he just couldn't take it."
Carrie stomped her foot in frustration. "Son of a bitch!" she shouted.
"It looks like he took the easy way out," Auburn said. "I say good riddance."
"Not the right way," Carrie shot back. "I wanted to see him dragged through the courts and sent off to rot in prison."
"If it all went through, sure," Auburn said. "If the court let us try him as an adult, and if his confession held up, and as long as there weren't any other loopholes or technicalities, maybe we'd get a conviction."
"That's a lot of ifs, Carrie. This way, it's nice and clean. Case closed."
Carrie looked at him, searching for his eyes behind his sunglasses.
"Did anybody go with you to that crime scene, Steve?"
He raised an eyebrow at her.
"You asking me if there was anyone else who can corroborate me saying what I saw?"
"Is there?"
"Paul was the first one on scene. He could see Eubanks slumped over on his desk, and he waited for me to get there before we busted the door open together. Any other questions, detective?"
Carrie laughed, trying to pass it off. "Hey, lighten up, Steve. I was just kidding around with you."
"No, I don't think you were," he said. "I think you're doing the same thing to me you did to Eubanks the other night. You smile at people, but that's just a mask, right? What behind it lies some pretty dark shit."
"Well, I've seen some pretty dark shit," Carrie said.
"I don't doubt it," Auburn said. "You ought to come up for air every once in a while before it keeps you there permanently."
He tipped his cowboy hat at her.
"It's been quite an experience working with you. Don't mind me saying, I hope we never do it again."
She watched him walk off. Another cowboy heading off into the dust, and was brushed aside by several people coming out of the diner all at once.
"Funeral's about to start," one of them said. "Hurry up or there won't be any parking spots left."
The crowd at the cemetery was too large to see who all was there. Carrie had searched faces at the church and left her seat early and stood on the steps as the door opened and the people flooded outside. A dozen cameras flashed, fodder for the news sites covering the funeral, and she realized the person she was looking for wasn't there. Not with all that press. Never in a million years. She found herself at the front of the crowd, near the casket, before they lowered it into the ground. People she knew from around town were nearby, but they were too far away to talk to. Across from her, Adam Krausen was dressed in a black suit and tie, his leg free of its cast, but he was still using crutches. Carrie held up his finger to him, trying to get his attention to tell him she needed him to wait for her after the ceremony. He lowered his face into a handkerchief in his hands, balancing himself on his crutches as he blew, wiped his sleeves on his eyes, and never looked back up. Mrs. Pugh let out a cry of despair, clutching her husband and burying her face in his chest. She moaned, "No," over and over. No tears streamed down Mr. Pugh's weathered face, but he did not look away once from his daughter's casket. A handsome woman with frosted blonde hair stood to Carrie's side, sobbing. She stumbled on the uneven ground and was forced to reach for Carrie's arm to keep from falling. Carrie held her steady, keeping her right hand wrapped around the woman's bony fingers, telling her it was fine as the woman apologized. "Did you know Hope?" Carrie asked. "No," the woman said, wiping her face and seeing her hands were soaked with tears. "I'm afraid I didn't. I was the dispatcher who took the call when her parents reported her missing. I was always hoping they'd find her. When I heard about the funeral, I just had to come." She looked around. "I've probably spoken on the phone to most of the people here. Heard them fighting with their loved ones. Talked to them when they wanted to hurt themselves. I could tell you more about their lives than anyone else. And yet I don't know any of them, and they don't know me." "I'm Carrie," Carrie said, patting her on the arm. "I'm Gloria," the older woman said. "Do you want me to walk you to your car?" "Actually, I have to visit someone buried here first. Someone I should have visited a long time ago." Carrie stayed with her, helping her search. They knew the number of the plot somewhere toward the rear of the cemetery. But it wasn't until they came upon it that Carrie realized what she was looking at. Oliver Rain, buried February 1981. Vietnam veteran, U.S. Army. Police chief of Patterson Borough. "Were you Ollie's dispatcher too?" she asked. Gloria nodded. "I was the last person to speak with him before he went into the woods. I've thought about that conversation a million times. What else I could have said, or what made him decide to do that?" She bent down to touch the headstone, laying her hand flat on its cold, rough texture. "It wasn't until after he died that I saw his picture. They had it in the paper," she said. "He really was a handsome man. At least I got that part right." She stood up and clasped Carrie's hand in hers, patting it before saying goodbye. Carrie watched her walk around the other graves, taking the long way, so as not to step on any of them. Carrie bent down to look at the grave marker. She placed her hand on it and said, "We did it, Ollie. We got the guy. Me and you. Rest easy now." "You two would have gotten along," a familiar voice behind her said. Carrie spun around so fast she almost toppled over. She cocked back her fist and punched him in the arm. "Rain! You son of a bitch, don't sneak up on me like that!
Where the hell have you been?
He was clean-shaven, wearing black sunglasses and an oversized black coat with the collar flipped up, something he could lower his head into. His hair was cut shaggy and short, like he'd done it himself. He looked past her down at his uncle's gravesite.
I never visited his grave, he said. I was gone by the time they buried him.
She put her hand in his, and he let her. She rubbed his forearm with her thumb, feeling the soft skin there. She touched the hard ridge of the scar that wrapped around his wrist and raised his hand to look at it in the light. The scar is fading, she said, squeezing his fingers and feeling him squeeze them back. How does it feel?
Like anything else that's been cut off and reattached. Sometimes all right, sometimes like it doesn't belong there, but never the same.
Carrie laid her head against his chest, feeling his warmth. Rain stroked her hair and said,
If you're going to arrest my father, you'd better do it soon. He won't be alive much longer.
Arrest him for what? Carrie said. All I heard were the ramblings of a dying old man. They walked across the cemetery toward the gated entrance at the end of a curving brick path.
I heard you met Adam, Rain said. He was shocked you figured out I was there so fast.
Were you shocked too? She said.
Only that it took you so long, he said, smirking.
She cocked back her fist like she wanted to hit him again, and he put his arm around her. They exited through the gate onto the sidewalk, walking along Auburn Street toward the center of town. The factory's old abandoned smokestacks loomed over the trees, the skeletal remains of the past when the town was still alive.
Is this your first time back here? Carrie asked.
When Jacob told her it was, she said,
And you haven't seen your dad in all these years?
We didn't part on good terms, he said. I realized a long time ago that he thought he was doing me a favor sending me away. But he didn't have to do it like that. The truth is, by the time I ran away, we were better off apart.
He told me he tried to make amends, but you refused, Carrie said.
A few years ago, he called me up, out of the blue, to tell me I should come see him. I offered to meet him for dinner somewhere. I didn't want to sit in his house and watch him get drunk. He told me he'd get back to me. I haven't heard from him since.
You should go to him, she said, before it's too late. He loves you. He misses you. So stop being so damn stubborn about it.
That doesn't sound like him, Rain said.
They kept walking.
Did you know it was Fred Eubanks all these years?
Of course, Rain said.
So why didn't you ever go after him?
Fred would never have let me interview him. We have too much history. I couldn't have done a proper job and couldn't bear to see anyone else do an improper job either, so I let it sit. What the case needed was a real detective. And then one came along, he said, squeezing her hand.
Some detective. I almost set my hotel room on fire with a bug zapper trying to use it as an alternate light source, Carrie said.
She reached up and rubbed her hand along his smooth chin.
I like you without the beard.
It was time for a change, he said.
That evening, Adam cooked dinner and opened a bottle of wine that he retrieved from the cellar.
Germans aren't known for their wines, he said, setting the bottle on the table. But the Riesling is well respected. My father got into collecting wine at one point, but he never drank any of it. I've got a few cases downstairs that I've been saving.
He looked at both of them and said,
Well, I guess this qualifies as a special occasion.
He poured three glasses and passed the first one to Carrie. She raised it to her nose and inhaled, smelling its jasmine and honeysuckle fragrance.
Dinner smells wonderful, Carrie said. I hope you like it. I've gotten into cooking over the past few years, but never get to do it for anyone else.
He finished his glass and moved to refill Carrie's before pouring more for himself. She stopped him and said,
No more for me.
I have to drive back tonight so I can file my report in the morning.
Just you and me tonight then, old friend, Adam said to Jacob.
I have a surprise for you. I got the Betamax player working and thought we could watch Excalibur for old time's sake.
He clasped his hands together as if holding a sword and intoned, In the name of God, Saint Michael and Saint John, I give you the power to bear arms and dispense justice.
It's Saint George, Rain said, the Dragon Slayer.
That's probably similar to the vow you both took when you became police officers, Adam said.
In the olden times, knights enforced the chivalric code. Honor. Protection of the innocent. In fact, that's the reason police badges are designed to look like shields. You shield the rest of us from harm. Pretty interesting, isn't it?
Jacob set his glass down on the table, cupping it with both hands.
Actually, I can't stay tonight either. I have to meet my son in Harrisburg first thing tomorrow morning.
Is everything all right? Carrie asked.
Rain glanced at her with uncertainty.
I didn't want to say anything at the diner because I hadn't decided to go through with it yet. Jacob Jr. has been hounding me since law school to take on my case. He's convinced he can clear my name. I'm meeting with him to get the paperwork started.
Carrie was stunned. I can't believe it, she said. Do you think it will work?
Rain swirled the last remaining drops around the bottom of his glass.
I suppose it's time we found out.
Chapter 30
I'm not letting you walk all the way to the bus depot, Carrie said, tossing Rain's bag into the back seat of her car. It was so worn out that its zipper came loose when it landed, sending paperwork flying. Carrie collected a large folded piece of paper from the car's floor and saw it was a map of VR County. There were circles drawn in the deeply wooded sections. What is this? Carrie asked, holding up the map.
Nothing, Rain said, reaching the ticket from her.
Carrie moved out of his reach, examining the markings. One of them was labeled Monica Gear and the date of her rape. He'd highlighted main roads leading in and out of each targeted area, which the suspect would need to escape. Rain had drawn lines between other circled locations, forming wide-ranging vectors, showing the suspect's most likely path of travel and what areas he might potentially concentrate on next.
Rain, this is incredible. Can I hold on to it?
It's not done yet. I will work on it and let you know, he said.
You should have shown it to Harv Bender and let him know where to start looking.
Harv helped me draw it, Rain said. We've been working on the case together.
You're kidding me, Carrie said.
Sometimes detective work is all about getting people to do what they want to do, even if they don't think they want to do it.
If you're going to get all zen on me, you need to grow the beard back, Carrie said.
It was dark by the time they arrived at the bus depot. It was crowded with confused-looking travelers hauling suitcases, trying to make sense of the station's terminals and where they were supposed to be. Homeless people picked through the trash cans or sat slumped against the depot's wall, muttering to themselves.
I can drive you to Harrisburg, Carrie said. This place looks disgusting.
It's fine, Rain said,
reaching into the rear of the car to grab his bag. He clutched the top part, trying to keep everything contained as he set it on his lap.
I'll call you in a few days, once I get settled at my son's house, he said.
Rain, she said, touching his wrist before he could get out. What changed your mind? Why are you letting him work on your case?
I've been thinking about the people who died to make me what I am, he said. I still owe.
Rain let himself out of the car, and Carrie sat watching him for as long as she could before he vanished into the sea of people. As she went to leave, she saw the folded map lying on the floor where it had fallen from his bag. She picked it up and unfolded it, studying the circles and where they were set against the rest of the map. There was one only a few miles away, she saw. What the hell, she thought. It couldn't hurt to take a look. The woods felt strange and lonely as she drove. The sky was covered with clouds, only letting the moon emerge briefly to reveal its pale, full roundness before being enveloped in mist once more. At least she could see the road, Carrie thought. A long stretch of backwoods and nothing but trees all around it. But it was straight and flat, and she was traveling within the circle Rain had marked on his map. She needed music, if only to fill the emptiness of the land around her. She wished, more than anything, that Rain had stayed. She checked the road to make sure no other cars were coming and picked up her phone and scrolled with one hand as she steered with the other, eyes glancing at the road and back, searching for something to listen to. It was a strange night that called for strange music, she thought. Something spooky to drive to. A song began playing through her phone, and she tapped the screen with her thumb until it stopped. She shut down the app, scrolled to her settings, made sure the Bluetooth was connected, scrolled back to the app, and restarted the song. It played through her phone again. When she looked up, her car had drifted into the oncoming lane. She cursed, righted the car, and tossed the phone into the passenger seat. It was a good thing the road was empty in front of her. She'd have plowed into someone for certain. Stupid technology. The more complicated they make things, the less they work. Red and blue lights flared to life in the mirror behind her, filling the dark woods all around with their brilliance. The police car on her tail toggled its high-pitched siren. "You have got to be kidding me," Carrie said. "Okay, think," she told herself. Her heart was hammering in her chest. She was out in the woods looking for a would-be rapist who used a police car. Now there was a police car behind her. "I was swerving," she thought. "Maybe it's a real cop. If it's a real cop, I'll just show him my badge and explain what I'm doing out here. If it's not, I'll show him my badge and stomp the shit out of him." The car zoomed ahead, nearly crashing into a rear bumper, jamming on the air horn on top of the siren now. "I'm pulling over, all right?" Carrie shouted. She yanked the wheel to the right, trying to get a look at the man sitting in the car behind her. It was too dark. She rolled down her windows, wanting to hear if he was using a police radio or not. "Come on," she whispered, wrapping her fingers around the handle of the pistol strapped to her waist. "Won't this be something if this is really a ticket?" she wondered. "If it's a cop, he saw me swerving and will probably give me a field sobriety test, whether I badge him or not." It occurred to her that she'd had wine with dinner that night. Holy shit, how much did I drink? It hadn't even been a full glass. She wasn't tipsy, was she? Either way, she was going to have to call Harve Bender as soon as it was over. She'd rather be the one to tell him she got pulled over than for him to hear it some other way. The car's spotlight switched on, filling Carrie's side-view mirror with light aimed directly at her face. She raised her hand to shield her eyes. She heard him approaching, and as she turned in her seat to look, another light appeared in her eyes. He was holding a flashlight, pointing it straight at her so she couldn't see him. Totally standard procedure, she thought. She'd done the same exact thing to everyone she pulled over at night. She squinted into the light, able to see a silver badge pinned above the man's left breast pocket. That looks real, she thought. She unbuckled her seatbelt and sat up, reaching around to pull her police ID out.
"You were swerving, ma'am," the man said.
"I know that. Hang on a second," Carrie said, her right hand stuffed in her back pocket, still digging for the ID. He thrust his hand through the open window and snatched Carrie by the throat. His gloved fingers clenched around her larynx so quickly that the oxygen seized inside her chest with no way to escape, threatening to burst her lungs. In that instant, he had her door open and was ripping her out of the car, hurling her onto the road at his feet. Carrie hit the loose asphalt stones and gasped, feeling it cut into her palms and knees. She'd caught herself in time to keep from cracking her skull, but even as she tried to roll away, the man reared back his heavy boot and kicked her in the side. "You dirty fucking whore," he shouted. "Out here swerving all over, trying to kill somebody." Carrie rolled with the kick and tried to scramble to her feet, but the world was spinning. He ran up and kicked her again. He dropped down on top of her, pinning her arms to the road and lowered his face over hers. "I'm gonna teach you what happens to cunts that break the law." He grabbed her by the throat again, cutting off her air. Carrie watched him raise a clenched fist high in the air, ready to cave her teeth in. With his body blocking the light of his car, she could make out the words printed on the badge. Security guard. He was about to swing when he felt the hard imprint of Carrie's gun barrel pressed against his sternum. He looked down at the gun in wide-eyed surprise, still choking her. Carrie was trying to pull the trigger, as if from 1,000 miles away. Her fingers were going numb. She could feel tears streaming down the sides of her face. Her entire left side was on fire from being struck, but she was pulling with all her might. Even as her life slipped away, she was pulling it as hard as she could. He let go of her and spun away just as the gun fired. The bullet struck her car, shattering the rim of her front tire and sending sparks flying through the air. She'd never heard the gun go off. She doubled over the second he let go of her, retching as she instinctively sucked in more air than her body could hold. From the road, she could see the man running for the driver's side door of his car, metal handcuffs draped around his belt at the center of his back, flapping as he ran. He was going to try to run her over, she realized, so she could never tell anyone what happened. He was reaching for the door when Carrie raised her gun again, gagging and sputtering as she tried to aim with shaking hands, and she fired. The glass window shattered above his hand, and he reeled back from it. Carrie staggered toward him, wobbling, but keeping the gun aimed steadily enough to make him raise his hands and back up. She got a better look at him then. He had the right look at first glance, but it was missing details. His black shoes were shined, but his white socks were a giveaway. His cheap nylon belt with no pouches or holster was a giveaway. His polyester uniform supply shirt with American flags on both sides was a giveaway. It was all cheap imitation. The car was an older model police vehicle, stripped of its decals and emblems. The vehicles were sold at auction all the time, and most came equipped with the door-mounted spotlight, because it was too expensive to get them removed. He probably bought the light bar online, she thought. The goddamn holes were likely still drilled in the roof when he went to mount it. She leveled the gun between his eyes, gripping it with both hands. He moaned and dropped to his knees, hands held high in the air. "But please, don't shoot me. I didn't do anything wrong. I was just trying to help." Carrie tried to speak, but needed to swallow and clear her throat, trying to force it to work right again. She wrenched her badge free and draped its chain around her neck, letting him get a good look at it. "Get down on the ground, face down, you piece of shit. You're under arrest." "I'm on your side, can't you see?" he moaned, clenching his eyes shut. "I just wanted to help the police and show I could protect people. You don't understand." He lowered his head, sobbing until spit bubbles popped between his lips. "Please don't take me to jail. You'll destroy my entire life." Carrie circled to his left, going around back of him, keeping the gun aimed at the center of his head. She kicked him in the center of his back as hard as she could, knocking him forward on his hands and face, his rear end raised high in the air. "Now put your hands behind your back, or so help me God, I will shoot you if you move a single inch." Carrie kept the muzzle of her gun pressed to the base of his skull with one hand, while she checked his pockets for weapons. She found a wallet in his back pocket and flung it open. "Stuart Gates," she said, reading his driver's license. He was even wearing his uniform in the driver's license photo. "I could kill you," she thought. "It would be easy. Just have him roll over and shoot him in the face. Tell them how he came at you, and while you were struggling, you got on top of him and fired off a lucky shot. End this. Right here. Right now."
"Please don't arrest me," Gates moaned. "I think I might be sick or something. I need help. I can't control myself. Can you please help me?"
"Shut up," Carrie shouted, grinding the front of her gun's barrel against the base of his skull. "Kill him. It's what he would do to you." She could hear Ben Rain's voice in her head, telling her how he'd systematically eliminated everyone involved in Ollie's death when he told her the truth about war.
"You don't spare the ones who plead for mercy. In war, you kill every fucking one of them."
Even Fred Eubanks had understood his part in everything was to die, to spare the system and the public the agony of enduring his presence any longer. Was this piece of shit any different? She'd killed before. The gun shook in her hand, her finger wrapped around the trigger so tightly its serrations were biting into her flesh. Kill him? For Monica Geer and Hope Pugh and all the countless other victims of men just like him? Son of a bitch! Carrie shouted, and jammed the gun back into her holster. She pulled out her handcuffs and snapped them around his right wrist and bore down on him with all her weight. She pinned his neck and arm to the street, twisting the cuffs against his wrist until he yelped. "Give me your other arm," she said. He rolled just enough for her to grab him by the other wrist, yank it behind his back, and get it cuffed. Carrie sat on top of him, knees wedged in his back and neck, catching her breath. She wiped sweat from her face and stood up. "Get to your feet," she said.
"I can't walk," he sobbed.
"Walk or I'll drag you," she said, pulling him upward by his handcuffs until the muscles in his shoulders threatened to tear. He staggered to his feet and Carrie steered him toward her back seat. "Get in and lie face down," she said. "Watch out for the roof of the car, duck your head." She watched him lie down like he was told. Carrie picked up her car's radio microphone and said, "Detective Santero to county." The radio dispatcher answered, "Go ahead for county." The moon had emerged once more, bathing the woods in its full blue light, falling on the creatures who hunt and the ones who are hunted alike. "I have one in custody," she said. "Assault on a police officer." Her badge's golden shield reflected the car's swirling lights as she leaned against the door, clutching her side and wincing. Sirens in the distance, growing louder. The road dogs were coming. And the traffic cops were coming. Hell, probably even a few bosses were coming. And she would be glad to see every single one of them. This has been a Highbridge production. Read by Neil Heligers, a member of SAG-AFTRA. Copyright 2019 by Bernard Schaefer. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. Recording copyright 2019 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.